For years, one statistic has echoed through policy reports, legislative hearings, and grant proposals like a gospel refrain. College in prison reduces recidivism by 40%. It's a powerful number. It's an encouraging number. But today we're going to ask something a little dangerous in corrections and public policy. We're going to ask, how confident are we really? Because belief is not evidence and correlation is not causation. Today's episode is a big one. After nearly a decade of waiting, Pennsylvania is finally receiving results from one of the most rigorous evaluation ever conducted of Pell-funded college programs in prison, a randomized controlled trial, the gold standard of social science. To walk us through what they found and what it actually means for practice, policy, and the future of correctional education, we're joined by Dr. Sarah Taumont from the University of Maryland, the lead evaluator on Pennsylvania's Second Chance Pell experiment. This is a conversation about evidence over enthusiasm, humility over hype, and how rigorous research can make us smarter even when the answers aren't as clean as we had hoped. You're listening to Pracademically Speaking, where practice meets evidence and sometimes challenges our assumptions.
Hello, I'm Brett Buckland, the host of Pracademically Speaking, a conversation where ideas and numbers get real. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Sarah Taumont, a professor at the University of Maryland, and I'm very excited for this episode to kick off our new year of episodes because we've been waiting for this highly anticipated results from a nearly decade-long groundbreaking evaluation of providing college courses to incarcerated individuals in prison. So, Sarah, welcome to the show. Thanks for being on.
Thanks, Brett. I'm thrilled to be here today to discuss research, which, of course, as most academic research is joint with several colleagues, including Dr. Jordan Hyatt from Drexel University. And we're really thrilled to be able to talk about these results, which were, you know, the evaluation was very generously funded by Arnold Ventures. And we wanted to acknowledge them as our funder, but also, you know, this, as you said, it's a decade-long collaboration between our research team, between the PADOC, and also the academic providers who have been providing college in prison since the start.
Yeah, this is very exciting. I have been waiting for this episode for like at least 2 years, and the results, of course. But before we get there, can you just briefly tell us about your background, your professional experience, and kind of what led you to be interested in evaluating college courses in prison?
Absolutely. There were two driving factors that led me to this research topic specifically. The first is that after a couple of years working in state government, I was inspired to go back to graduate school to study public policy to better understand the sort of like scientific basis of, you know, what we should be doing as government to intervene, you know, when markets fail, as they say. And my focus in policy school started thinking about prison policy because, you know, unlike a lot of the determinants of social disadvantage, prison is an entirely policy-built environment. It's an environment where policymakers have a lot of influence and ability to intervene in ways that will shape people's outcomes, both during their time in prison and also post-release. And yet, there are many improvements that we can make. And I could see that as an outsider before I went to grad school. And then while I was in grad school, I served on the faculty of what was then called the Prison University Project, but what is now called Mount Tamalpais College, which was a college program in San Quentin State Prison. Of course, now they've also changed the name of that. It's now called San Quentin Rehabilitation Center. And I saw firsthand the effect that college, you know, could have on people. I heard really inspiring stories from my students about the ways that going to college was really changing their lives. Examples like a student telling me that he felt more confident as a parent in inspiring his kids to take school seriously because he was doing so himself. And probably the most profound example I noticed was a student who I taught both in the pre-college program and then several years later in the statistics program in the associate's degree. In the beginning of my time working with him, he told me he wanted to sort of get a commercial driver's license and become a trucker when he left prison, because he was determined to turn his life around and not come back to prison after years, you know, working in the drug trade and in gangs and stuff like that. But after several years in the program, he actually told me that his aspirations had changed and that over time in college, he had sort of grown as a student, and his aspiration was now to go to Berkeley as part of the Underground Scholars Initiative and to finish his bachelor's degree at UC Berkeley. And so I saw these examples sort of what could happen, but combined with my training in you know, social science, it really led me to start to think about, like, okay, well, what is the effect on the whole? Because even though I had these examples of things that were really inspiring and clearly important, that wasn't necessarily the case for all the students in the classroom. So yeah. I wanted to understand better.
Awesome. Well, let's jump into the study that you've done, the evaluation here. And I want to kind of start with the headline and then peel it back.
Sure.
So first question would be, what's the top line findings on recidivism employment? What did you find at a high level?
Yeah. So those are our primary outcomes for the study. Of course, we're interested in other things. But, you know, as we start out in social science and field research, we're sort of asked to declare our two most important things. And that's what we chose. So when it comes to recidivism, we find, I think it's really important to note, we find very small differences, really nearly negligible differences between the group who were awarded a Pell Grant and those who weren't. Basically on the order of 0.8 of a percentage point. So basically we find that the treatment group is 0.8 percentage points less likely to come back to or be rearrested in the year
following.
And
the treatment
release.
Group being the Pell, the group that received Pell college courses.
That's right. Maybe it would help to sort of set up the study a little bit before we start. So the setup of the study is that we wanted to understand, make appropriate comparisons between people who went to college in prison and those who didn't. And in order to do that, what we did was PADOC was screening applicants to the program. They were, in order to get into the program, of course, a person had to be eligible to get a Pell Grant. They went through a screening process. PADOC worked with each of the college providers to determine eligibility for the Pell Grants. And then, of course, there are only a scarce number of seats in the classroom, so not everybody could get the program. As a result, when it came time to among the people who were eligible to get a Pell Grant, when it came time to choose who would get in and who wouldn't, PADOC used the most fair method of allocating those seats, which is a fair lottery, basically a coin toss of who would get in and who wouldn't, given that everybody in the pool was eligible. What that meant is that it splits that group into two: the treatment group, those who got offered a seat in one of the classes, and those we call the control group, those who just like didn't happen to win the lottery. And they went about their business and, you know, did whatever it is that they would do when they didn't get into the class. But as a result, we're able to say any differences that we observe between these two groups has to be due to college, because that's the only thing that distinguishes the two groups. So when I say that the treatment group and the control group are not very different on recidivism, that's what I mean. So on average, we found that the treatment group was 0.8 of one percentage point less likely to get arrested within a year than were the controls.
And what about employment? Do you have the findings on employment yet?
I do. In terms of employment, we're looking at a very specific outcome. So we're looking at the chance that someone was employed for two or more quarters of the first year that they got out.
Okay.
So basically we're looking at, were they employed did they report like official employment in a majority of the year, the first year that they got out of prison. And we found that the treatment group is actually slightly less likely to be employed than is the control group. So the treatment group is 2.6 percentage points less likely to be employed than is the control group. But going back to both of these, I think one of the things that it's hard to sort of put those percentage point numbers in perspective, right? It's really important to compare them to the base rate. So like, what do we think that people would be doing in the absence of, like how big is 2.6 right. percentage points, okay? So what it really matters is we compare that to the control group, and the control group average is our understanding of what would be happening to the treatment group if they hadn't gotten college, because they are the appropriate comparison. So it's important to know, at what rate did the control group get arrested when they left prison? And the answer is not very much, right? So only about 15% of the control group got arrested in the year following prison. And so when we say that the treatment group got arrested 0.8 percentage points less, right? What that means is that they were arrested
14.2 percentage points, right? But overall, low risk group. I mean,
they are a very low risk group.
Low base rate, as you said, of recidivism. Yeah.
That's right. Employment is a bit of a different story. Close to 60% of the control group were employed in the year for two or more quarters in the year following prison. So, or following release from prison. And so when we think about, okay, the treatment group is employed 2.6 percentage points less, that means that they were employed about 4% less likely to be employed.
So that's the bottom line, kind of high level findings from the study. Again, peel it back a little bit and also contextualize it a little bit, because as you know, there's been a lot of hype around this topic. There was a study, you could speak more to it before we go into the break, about that that said basically that, if I understand correctly, that college courses or college and prison can reduce recidivism by 40%, which is a huge number. And then there's a whole history to this too, with Pell being taken away from in prison, being offered in prison, and then it was brought back under the Obama administration, and then a lot of interest in evaluating that, and then that 40% headline. So what makes your study unique in terms of really understanding, like really truly, what's the impact of Pell?
Yeah, that 40% statistic is something that has, like, you know, followed me around. I felt like a little nag on my shoulder ever since I started this evaluation. And one of the reasons that it was, you know, it really has haunted me over time is that it really took off in the sort of policy conversation. There are op-eds in the New York Times, in various like outlets, basically saying like, look at the difference. Look at the huge differences in recidivism between people who go to college in prison and people who don't. And one of the things that the authors of that study, and this is something that actually I wrote into the New York Times, a letter to the editor saying like, hey, one of the things that you forgot to mention about this study that you're citing is that the authors of that study were actually very careful to say that the scientific rigor of the evidence is really sort of like not at the level that we would want to draw causal conclusions here. And what I mean by that is basically what they were saying is, from a scientific perspective, we're not able to make the strong comparisons or appropriate comparisons that we would want to make. One of the things that we think about a lot in the social sciences is we want to make appropriate comparisons, compare apples to apples. And how do we do that? Well, one of the things that we're concerned about is there are differences among people that we can observe and that we can measure in our data. And the studies that came up with, you know, that 40% statistic are ones where they really try to take into account factors that we can measure that would make people different. Prior educational attainment, maybe the likelihood of being employed before you went, or other things like maybe your income or your marital status or other things that would lead to you being more or less likely to go to college. But what those studies could not account for, which our study can account for, are things that we both cannot observe and cannot measure, like intrinsic qualities, especially things like motivation to change your life, a decision to do differently moving forward. That's not something we can observe. It's not something we can measure, but it is something that might drive someone to choose college in prison and might also drive them to be less likely to get rearrested in ways that maybe would not be true among their counterparts who don't choose. And that might be confounding, right? What our understanding of the difference between those two groups is. So what our study does, in the way that I explained before, is it basically balances and makes sure that the only difference between the two groups that we're looking at in our study is a flip of a coin.
Mm-hmm. So it isolates that impact of college education from all the other factors that might differ between those who got it and those didn't.
That's right. Yep. It not only balances things we can observe, and we can show that in our work, but it also balances things we can observe, and that's the thing that's so important.
Yep. Well, we need to take a quick break. When we get back, we'll continue our discussion on higher education in prison with Dr. Sarah Tomont. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Pracademically Speaking, a production of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Please share or cite any of the guests or content you hear on this podcast, but do not alter the audio in any way. Check for resources or publications mentioned in this episode in the show notes. Now, back to the host.
We're back with Sarah Tomont discussing the first results from her evaluation of Pell-funded college courses within the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. Sarah, one of the interesting parts of this study is the distinction you make between drawing between potential benefits from individuals and limits on population-level impacts. Can you unpack that distinction a little bit and why it's important for policymakers to understand?
I'm happy to do that. So one of the things that I didn't mention when I was talking about our results is that when we think about the sort of statistical confidence interval, the confidence intervals around our recidivism estimate are really wide. So what that means is that even though I talked about the sort of like small difference on average between the treatment and control group, we also have to account sort of for the statistical uncertainty. And what that means is we actually can't rule out an effect as large as like a 38% reduction in recidivism.
So that 0.8 percentage points different could be up to 38%.
That's right. If we consider a population, sort of like what might be happening in the population, and that's just sort of a thing we have to deal with when it comes to statistical analysis. So what that means is that it's very possible that the true population effect for individuals is quite a large reduction. Okay, but the hype around this intervention has always been that this is really the answer to reducing recidivism. And what we found in our study is one of the things that's going to hold this back from having its maximal possible effects, right, is the fact that there are very few people who are actually eligible for an intervention like this. And so when we look, we just did a sort of back of the envelope exercise and we said, okay, well, imagine a situation in which every single person who could possibly, like every single person who could possibly be eligible for this program, it's about 16% of the population, 15.6% of the population. And imagine that every single one of them has the maximum possible benefit that they could have. Exactly.
Yeah.
Every single one. Now, we don't think that this is likely, but this is like, this is this program at its best advantage doing the best it possibly could. The overall recidivism rate for the 1-year recidivism rate for the state of Pennsylvania, The overall rearrest rate at 1 year for people getting out of prison in the state of Pennsylvania is 25.7%. If everybody who was possibly eligible for Pell gets the maximum, participates in the program and gets the maximum possible benefit, that number would go down to 24.6%. So the maximum possible reduction at a statewide level for recidivism in Pennsylvania is about 1.1 percentage points, or about like a 4 to 5% reduction in recidivism.
And you're saying that's because it applies to such a small group of people who are actually eligible, even under the most optimistic situation where it's a huge drop in recidivism, it's still a very limited group of individuals who are eligible for college courses in prison.
That's exactly right.
Okay. So based on everything you've learned from this experience experiment, what should we do here at the Department of Corrections in terms of higher education? Are you saying that we should get rid of college courses? Is there another avenue that's more promising? What's your takeaway from the evaluation?
Yeah, I want to be perfectly clear. One of my biggest fears in, sort of disseminating these results is that people would take from what I'm saying that they should not invest in higher education and prisons. I don't think that's the appropriate response. I do think what our research shows is that as the sort of panacea policy solution for how to reduce recidivism, this cannot be it. But what I would encourage policymakers to do is think about what should be the first order educational intervention for this population. One of the reasons that so few people are eligible for a Pell Grant is actually one of the criteria that I think PADOC wisely imposes, which is to try to get some assessment of whether or not someone's academically ready to take college courses. What we know from the education research is just because you have a high school diploma or a GED doesn't mean you're ready to go to college. PADOC does some testing to figure out whether or not people are sort of reading at the level that they might need to be successful in college courses. And that reading score is one of the things that sort of like holding a lot of people in the population back from being able to participate. And so thinking about like what is the educational intervention that could really help?
And what could that be? Basic education, college prep, other stuff that
now you're asking me to speak beyond my expertise. I don't think that we know quite yet.
Sure.
But I do think like one of the important things is not to give up on college. We have seen people come out of these programs and go on to success that people could barely imagine coming out of prison. So it's really important to note that this isn't something that we're not showing evidence that higher education is not beneficial.
Yeah. Well, this is excellent. Give us 2 minutes at the end here to explain why this is such an important study, other than the 40% statistic that's out there that we talked about before. But why is this such a big deal nationally? What's the national context for why this is such a big deal?
The thing that made this possible in the first place was that the Obama administration said, well, Pell Grants have been banned in prison since the 1990s. We're going to see, they heard all of the sort of lore about the benefits of education. And they said, well, what would happen if we reinstated Pell on an experimental basis? Since then, in 2016, when the program started, efforts legislatively have meant that actually Congress reinstated Pell eligibility for every person who is incarcerated nationwide. So what that implies, right, is that there is a sort of like flood of renewed attention, investment, and energy into higher education in prisons. And this has sort of like a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it means a lot of opportunities for people. But on the other hand, it means there are, potentially precarious implications of a flood of new providers on the market trying to implement college programming in prisons who may or may not, you know, have the experience.
And like you said, it was hyped up as kind of the panacea, which has a potential opportunity cost to invest in other things too, if everyone's saying this is the thing, which there has been a lot of hype about. But that's why your study has been so important. And we're out of time, so we got to leave it here, unfortunately, as it was getting good. But Sarah, thanks for the discussion. I'm really excited to get these results and have our audience listen to the results. And this is exciting stuff. We have a good collaboration together, so I'm sure you'll be here talking about other evaluations, hopefully not in 10 years again. Thanks again for this major contribution to the field. And thank you to the listeners, and we'll be back in a few weeks with another episode of Pracademically Speaking.
Thanks for listening. Check out Pracademically Speaking wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. This is the conversation where ideas and numbers get real, on the ground and in practice. Pracademically Speaking is a production of the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections.